Welcome back to University of Minnesota Extension's Nutrient Management Podcast. I'm your host, Nora Nolden, Communications Specialist here at Extension. Today on the podcast, we're talking about on-farm research. We have three members of Extension's Nutrient Management team, Dan Kaiser, Brad Carlson, and Annie Nelson, to cover the basics and beyond. So welcome, everybody. Let's do a quick round of introductions.
This is Dan Kaiser. I'm a State Nutrient Management Specialist at the University of Minnesota. I do a fair amount of work on farm, with some smaller plot and some larger plot trials. It's my 10 years here in Minnesota.
Annie Nelson here. I work out of the St. Cloud Regional Office as a Regional Extension Educator, working with nitrogen management and water quality on coarse textured soils.
I'm Brad Carlson. I work out of our regional office in Mankato, and I do also water quality related work and other nutrient management topics, and I cover the whole state, at least at this point.
All right, so let's talk about the basics of what makes a good on-farm test.
Well, one of the things you have to remember is with on-farm testing, I think the first thing is just getting your expectations to a point at which you can set something up that you can effectively test. And that's always, I think, the issue I see with a lot of people is you get a lot of expectations in terms of having a lot of treatments out there, and you can test a lot of things. And when we're starting to talk about research, particularly with large-scale field trials, you really need to kind of temper things down and look at trying to parse it down into maybe some smaller questions and not trying to answer everything all at once, because doing a good job really in terms of the design is really important in terms of making sure you're getting good data.
Yeah, I think the advent of having yield monitors has really changed this dramatically over what it used to be. I've been involved with doing on-farm trials since before yield monitors, when we were simply weighing everything out with weigh wagons. And obviously this has put it in the grasp of most farmers to do these things, but it's quite frequent when I'll hear farmers say, well, I tried this on one field, so we'll see how that looks, or I split the field in half and I applied such and such, and so forth. And I think what we really need to do is really remind farmers that if you're actually going to answer the question that you're trying to get at, you need to design this properly. And so, you know, we could take any field that you farm, if let's just say you've got 10 of them, and there'll be a rank of 1 to 10 on which one yielded the best and which one yielded the worst. And similarly, if you just simply split the field in half, there will always be one half that yielded higher than the other half. And so it's really important that if you're going to do on-farm research, that you first of all, you define your question properly, and then you design it properly.
There's a few things I think you should be looking at when you're designing this. One of them would possibly be your location, and that's just choosing the right field to do this on. Maybe you have done research in the past on your farm that's on the field really close to the home, and there's been a bunch of different products on there, or maybe you have a manure history on there. That's definitely going to affect your results. So really thinking about where you want to put this trial. Maybe you have some place that gets more sunlight. Maybe you have a spot that's eroded. Thinking about those things before you really pick one specific field. Maybe that's just for convenience issues.
And Brad brought up, I think, a really good point, talking about your different fields and ranking them in terms of yield, because it's one of the things that concerns me with some of this testing is that a lot of people get really wrapped up in these 1-2 bushel yield increases, because a lot of times that's all it would take to pay for product X to put it in the field. The issue, though, is what you need to consider is, say you split a field, you put the product on a half. If the product did nothing, granted, if you didn't do anything, would those two halves of those fields yield the same? And that's why we use statistics, which I know seems to be a lot of times we seem to kind of go away with a lot of people not really wanting to get heavy into statistics. But really with these on-farm, you don't really need to do anything major. It's just mainly getting an idea with your replication what your error is, which essentially is that variation that that field's imposing versus what the variation that your treatment's imposing. Getting a good handle on what that is to make sure that when you make a decision based on your data, that decision is accurate based on something that's meaningful, because that's really the problem. Is without statistics, it's why we use it. We really don't know if that product does something, or whatever you're doing or you're trying to do does something.
Well, that's right. And even before that, you need to make sure that you're actually even able to collect numbers. I was familiar with a situation a number of years ago where a farmer was encouraged to try a fungicide. And so the dealer actually applied fungicide in a diagonal stripe across the field and said, well, let's see if we can see this when you harvest next fall. And lo and behold, they did see it when they harvested. But if you looked at the individual data points, what you'll discover was that the fungicide delayed maturity by a little bit, and that the crop was actually a lot wetter in that stripe. And in addition, because it was diagonal, you couldn't ever really actually pull out what the yield difference was. And so in that particular instance, it really was what I would define as a poorly designed trial. You saw something in the field, but you really had no way of quantifying it when it was all said and done.
And the other thing, too, is I get a lot is everybody says, well, this is easy. We can do it. It's easy. We just need a yield monitor. We can measure it. And that's really not the attitude you really want to see in terms of setting these things up, because really you want to take your time and make sure that you're doing a good job, because you can really screw these things up really quickly if you're not thinking ahead, particularly when you're out there with the planter. If you put something out pre-plant and you've got two hybrids in the planter or something else where you confound your treatments, and then essentially then what you did with all the planting really goes out the window and you really can't get a whole lot out of it. So it shouldn't really be easy to do that good of a job. I know it's easy to collect the data with your yield monitor, but you really have to put some thought in terms of what you're doing for treatments, how it's being set up, and making sure that everything is there, that you're making a good direct comparison, and that you're not confounding a bunch of factors together where you can't really separate out what, if you do get a yield response, what's giving you that effect.
Yeah, that's a good point, Dan, because we had, you're familiar with a project we did a few years ago that was a fertility trial, and our cooperator really wasn't on the same page as we were, and he ended up planting literally four different corn hybrids in the field that was to house the trial. And that just messed everything up, because obviously we weren't running a variety trial, we were running a fertility trial. And so at that point, we really had a mishmash of where the varieties fell from one to the other. And I'm even familiar with a different project that I was involved in a couple years later, where I happened to be riding along with the farmer when we were planting, and he made a comment to me that he was running out of corn and we were going to have to stop and put some more in the seeder. And I just offhand, based on the experience previously, said, and of course you have the same hybrid, right? Oh no, I'm out of this one. We're going to switch to whatever. And I said, well, we can't do that. We're running a trial in this field and you can't switch corn hybrids in the middle of the field. And, you know, those are some of the small things where it seems really obvious and almost maybe like humorous or so forth, or like we're kind of poking the people that were involved. Well, we're not mentioning names. But in reality, when things get busy in the spring, these are the things that happen. And then you're sitting there in the fall trying to decide, you know, well, I looked at such and such, now how do I evaluate this? And in reality, you are left with a situation that can't be evaluated.
Well, and that's one of the things we run into a lot. And as Brad mentioned, it's a major issue is when you start looking at your planning, is that if you start talking to your co-op agronomist, you make a plan in terms of we want to do X, they aren't necessarily the person that goes out there and actually does the work. So maybe Y gets done, and then it messes things up. So that's the thing where why I really stress is not taking the attitude that this is really easy, that anybody can do it. While, you know, there's a lot of opportunities out there, you really need to have some thought into it and some careful planning just to make sure what gets done is what you intended. Otherwise, you just really salvaging data at that given point in time. It's really not worth it, because you make some pretty erroneous results just with some bad results if you've got confounded data.
Yeah, and in addition to that, as far as your crop inputs are concerned, we also need to be careful beyond the seed. And we ran into a situation a couple of years ago where it turned out that the cooperator we had identified was going to apply his herbicide with 32% ammonium urea ammonium nitrate. and that was going to mess up our fertility trial. You know, and it's like, well, you need to think about those things where if you're doing a nitrogen trial and all of a sudden, well, I was going to apply my herbicide pre-planned as impregnated urea or something like that. Well, you can't variable rate your herbicide. So all of a sudden that also messes things up. And so there's really a lot of advanced planning that needs to go into this just simply to make sure that the site is actually going to be able to, I guess for lack of a better term, accept the project that you want to put there, the evaluation you want to do there.
Yeah, and we really encourage you, if you're interested in answering a question or looking at a new product, to do a field trial on your farm, but really thinking critically about what is the question you want to answer. And going back to those confounding factors that Dan and Brad mentioned, picking one thing and keeping everything else the same. And also going back to the importance of the randomization and the replication. So at the university, we're known for doing a lot of replication, and some people may not understand why, but it really is to look at if these things actually make a difference out in the field. So if you're looking at one thing versus your normal practice, maybe you want to bump down your N rate or up your N rate or use a different product. Doing about six strips, three of one and three of the other, is a good comparison, instead of just doing half the field and another half the field in one thing.
And one of the things I see a lot, too, with product testing out there, too, is there seems to be, you see a lot of trials where they'll maybe use a farmer rate and a farmer rate with the product and then mm-hmm. the product with a reduced rate. And that's an issue where you start looking at it is you really need to have that comparison or that reduced rate without that product as well, because... Again, that goes back to just making sure you're comparing apples to mm-hmm. apples. Is otherwise, essentially, what you're running into is you don't have any uncertainty whether or not you could have reduced that rate without that product if that treatment wasn't in there. So that's really where the planning needs to come mm-hmm. in. Just make sure that you have good direct with and without comparisons for whatever you do, and then you can make some comparisons based on that data.
And I've occasionally run into farmers who wanted to test a quote-unquote system where they were looking at some interaction with tillage and fertility and pest management and so forth. Very, very difficult to do on a field strip because if you've got, say, you know, one managing it one way versus managing it another and all those things are different, now you don't really know whether or not it was just simply one of those factors or whether it actually was the system that drug that out. And so it is important to isolate what we're trying to look at. In addition to the replication part, and I also had experience with a project a few years ago that had a tillage component, and the farmer said somewhere towards fall, keep an eye on that last strip out there that you're harvesting. Well, why? Well, because I went over that twice. I wanted to see if it made a difference. Well, whoops. Now we don't know whether the treatment actually affected things or whether it was because you tilled this a second time. You know, all those things have to be kept under control in order to make sure we actually end up with usable data. The other thing is to make sure that it's actually randomized. I had a situation back a few years ago. This actually covers a lot of ground or a couple of different topics. But we had a situation with a tillage trial that I did, and it's almost probably 15 years ago now. And we were looking at strip till versus just simply going in with a spring field cultivator on soybean stubble for corn. And we replicated three times, and I just simply randomized by flipping a coin because there was two treatments. And, of course, if you've got treatment A and treatment B, it could either be AB or BA. So one of those in three replications is going to be repeated twice and the other one time. When we went across the field and we were taking the yield data, the yields went something like this. And starting on the south, they were 174, 182, 189, 195, 200, 207, and so forth. And so what we actually saw when all was said and done was that the yields got increasingly better as we moved from south to north. And so if you didn't actually randomize your treatment, if you were just simply going every other one, well, obviously it didn't even matter what the treatment was. Every treatment that you placed on the north side was going to yield higher than the treatment on the south side did. In our particular instance, we decided that this trial really wasn't even salvageable at all on account of that factor. It's something that we also wanted to mention was passing the smell test. But when you look at the data and you see that trend, in this case, there was a statistical difference that said the strip till was better. Yet when we looked at it, I said, well, we don't really know that. All we really know is that the north side of the field yielded better than the south side of the field, and the farther north we got. And I don't know what previous management happened out there to cause that effect. But again, it really brings home why you need to randomize, because had you just simply said it's going to be this one, this one, it's going to be BA, 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 BA all the way across the field, it didn't matter what the treatment was. Whichever one was the north side was going to be your better yielding.
So at the end of a trial, what should you do with your data? How do you handle it, and how do you analyze it?
Well, one of the things that I would really suggest is, you know, really looking at your data, because Brad brought up that point with those alternating strips, and I've seen that too with randomized strips where we ended up just by chance and placement where our applied strips were in higher yielding areas that we ended up with a large yield response, and these were boron trials. And I think you look at the data really indicates to me that if you look at just how we had the trial laid out, that was a lot of why we had the yield response. It wasn't anything to do with the treatments. It was just we had higher yielding areas of the field where we had the applied treatments for some reason, just by chance, even with the replication. So really, I mean, that's the starting point, is you really, one, need to make sure your data is clean, getting rid of some of those outlier points. And then two, just then look at it. I mean, just an overall map of the field, look at it, kind of how your strips lay in there, and just see if there's any patterns. And this was pretty clear that the boron data was by soil type, and you could just see it clearly how the yield was following the soil map. So looking at that, I mean, that's one of the reasons why you use that kind of data, then you start saying that there's a large yield response when there might not necessarily be, and then you're going to make a wrong decision. Now, on that particular trial, if you're applying a few pounds of boron incorrectly, you're wasting money. I mean, it probably isn't the end of all things, but there's certainly circumstances out there where you could actually be harming yield by some over applications if you made a wrong decision.
Yeah, I think the next thing with collecting good data is to make sure that your yield monitor is calibrated. Obviously, the gold standard would be to have a weigh wagon out there and check what the weigh wagon says to what the yield monitor says. That's really not feasible. In most cases, it kind of takes away your advantage of doing on-farm research, which is to not have to stop and slow everything down. It is important, though, to make sure, for one thing, that your combine passes are actually over your treatment, that you don't end up splitting, because that will happen, particularly with fertilizer treatments, which are in feet, versus other treatments, which are in rows. That can happen. And the other thing, of course, is to make sure that your yield monitor is calibrated. We have been witness to various situations where farmers have not calibrated their yield monitor appropriately, or where we've been there when it's been calibrated and we know enough to say, I don't think that's the proper procedure, to which the operator's manual got pulled out and we ended up spending a bit more time on it. But that's probably the next step. I think the last thing involving that, though, is also to try and harvest the plot area all in one time. If you are having storage and dryer issues where you say, well, I'm only going to be able to take half this field and then I'm going to have to wait for the dryer to catch up, or I'm, you know, I don't know if the truck's going to show up to unload or something like that. If you're collecting part of your yield map in the morning and part of it at night, we've seen a lot of instances just simply looking at yield maps where you'll see differences from morning to night, and particularly in cases where a field was started to be harvested and they came back, say, a week or two later because it was raining. you know, which is another point, don't start collecting yield data on a plot area when the forecast is bad. If you think you know that you're going to get rained out at some point, go somewhere else. Because if you come back several days later, you're going to see some differences. And again, that gets very difficult to interpret the data at that point.
Well, it's one of the things, too, I'd like to suggest is, as Brad said, you really need to have some planning when you start talking about how you overlay your strips. And with a lot of our fertilizer trials, I really try to keep it so our strips are at least around 3 times the header width. So I can get, as I like to have 2 passes up and back on each strip, just to mitigate any issues we may have with the flow going through the combine. If you're going uphill, down a hill, I mean, it kind of gives a, then it gives you more data points as well. But that takes careful planning in terms of that and making sure that everything's where it should be. And you know, I'm kind of about 50-50 usually on my on-farm trials, and we try to set them up counting planter rows whether or not we're going to be in the right spot at the end of the season. But it is something to really try to do as much as you can, because you don't want to be harvesting a edge row where you're harvesting 2 strips at once, because really then your data is no good. There's not anything you really can do about it at that point in time.
And you do need to also give some thought when you're laying it out about your harvest width. The advent of big corn heads has caused some problems with that also. When we've got 12 rows that we're trying to take out all at once, that makes it much more difficult than we were only taking 6 rows or 8 rows out. It just adds a little extra complication to that.
Yeah. So I think moving on from collecting good data is all great suggestions, but what do you do after you get this good data? And that comes down to your analysis and statistics. So your yield monitor or weigh wagon is really just going to give you an average of what that strip was. But what you really should do is go back and plug in all your treatments, maybe to an Excel file, and look at the difference between all these treatments. Maybe you have some that are really high, maybe you have some that are really low. And looking at something that we call LSD, a least significant difference, and finding whether plus or minus this treatment was maybe plus or minus 5 pounds different than the next treatment. And is there really a difference between something that averaged 200 bushels and something that averaged 205 bushels? Maybe there's a lot of noise in that data, a lot of high ones, a lot of low ones, but you're getting an average. So that's something really to educate yourself about if you're unsure of it, and look at that before making any conclusions.
That's one of the things, and I think I said this before, if you have no treatment effect out there, don't expect that essentially your yields are going to be exactly the same, because by chance, if you did nothing in that field, if you had the same treatment structure, you're still going to have differences out there that could exist just because of the variability that's within that field. Excel, if you do have that, there are some options with the analysis tool pack, depending on what version you have, where you can do some analysis of variance, which is a pretty simple technique for it. And you can actually find on the web in terms of how to do that. It's pretty simple to do in Excel. And I think there's some websites, too, that you can go in and plug your numbers in, and it'll just calculate a probability value based on that the data you have. So there's some options out there if you have some pretty simple studies in terms of what you can do for statistical analysis, just to see how your data stacks up.
Yeah, I think in addition to finding that least significant difference, it's also worth kind of looking at just what that number is. Mm-hmm. If the least significant difference is 8, 9, 10 bushels an acre and you have that, obviously you've got something going on. Well, Dan's familiar with the trial we did a couple of years ago when all was said and done, the LSD on a field that was half a mile long was 2 bushels an acre. Incredible consistency in that field. But a lot of us that have done a lot of on-farm research kind of question, like, well, geez, is if you find a difference that's 3 bushels an acre, even though the statistics says that's significant, we really have a hard time believing that that was accurate. And you know, the point of that is, most of those are done to, say, a 90% confidence interval. If it's 90, and a lot of times in agriculture we'll go lower than that, we'll go 80%. But let's just say 90%. That means that 10% of the time it's going to tell you that there was a difference out there, but it was false. And so we need to also kind of take a look at that data and say, okay, so statistically this was significant, but was it really? And in the case where it was a very small difference, we need to somewhat question that too.
So what should you look for in your reporting to ensure that your data is good?
Well, I think some of the tools that we're talking about with the statistical tools that are out there are some options out there that you can at least generate some of those probability values. And if you're below a probability of 0.1, that means there's a good chance that there's a real difference out there. One of the things, though, that you have to realize, and this is when you're looking at any data, that particularly when you're looking at product data, is that you're going to be getting essentially the best of the best in terms of what they found. And really what I like to see when I look at a lot of our product testing is both the responsive and non-responsive, just to get an idea of what percentage of the time did it work, because it gets back to what Brad was talking about with those error rates, that even at like a 0.2, we'd expect 1 out of 5 chance for a false positive. At a 0.1, it'd be 1 out of 10. That they're going to be out there. I mean, they happen, and you can expect possibly to see some of that if you see reporting values. And really, a lot of times, too, I mean, it is kind of what we deal with a lot, is the testimonials that are out there, that a lot of times, too, the data is a little bit marginal. You look at some of the ads you're seeing, but the testimonials go a long way in terms of selling a lot of these products and practices. So kind of waiting between those two, trying to figure out the good and the bad is really, really the issue when you start looking at trying to make decisions based on the data that's out there.
Yeah, I'd be really careful if I'm looking at non-replicated data but collected over many sites. I know that we in Extension do use that type of data, particularly like for variety trials, where we'll have, say, a marker variety that we plant in all the trials, and then instead of replicating, we let our sites be the replication. But one thing you need to be very, very careful about when looking at data like that is to ensure that whoever collected it didn't cherry pick the right strip coming out of the field to make it look the way they wanted to. You know, is it the whole field average, or did they take combine passes multiple times until they finally got the number that they wanted? And again, I'm not saying that this is a real widespread practice, but we've also heard firsthand from instances where this has happened. And so I think you do need to at least be on guard for that situation. I think the other thing is you also have to keep in mind, this gets a little back to what we were talking about before regarding whether you've got significant differences, is putting the economics to this. It's not just simply did you find a significant difference, but did it even pay for itself? Did it pay for the product? Are there other costs? Because, like, for instance, when we're talking about doing a lot of fertility work, if we're talking about side dress, you've got an entire application cost, and maybe a $9, $10 an acre application cost that you wouldn't have had at all. So it's not just simply the product, it's going back over the field. Did you use some technology that you had to pay for? I mean, is it a crop model that was $4, $5, $6 an acre? Did you do extra soil sampling or tissue sampling that had a per acre cost? You know, all those things need to be considered when looking at, and I've heard the you know, a lot of the advertisements where they've said things like, well, at the cost of this is only a couple bucks an acre, you only need a third of a bushel to pay for this. Also, a reminder, you can't really measure a third of a bushel with any of these, any on-farm technology for measuring yield. So you'll never know with that kind of stuff. But it is important to also think about the economics.
And there's a lot of reliance on yield, and we do understand that yield pays the bills when it comes down to it in terms of deciding what these products are doing anything. The main issue, and it's what I'll be talking about in CPM Short Course, is you know, looking at a lot of the product claims in terms of what they do. A lot of times just measuring a yield increase doesn't necessarily prove that that product's doing what it's supposed to be doing. And a lot of times we run into issues with a product that might be a microbial enhancer, something that claims that it works by enhancing microbial activity, but they throw a micronutrient package in with it as well. And you know, how do you sort out what did what, and is there a different option with that? So that's really the main thing with that. And then when I look at really passing the smell test, when I look at data, is really, again, looking at that apples-to-apples comparison, because showing me a farmer rate versus product X plus a reduced rate really doesn't prove to me that that product works if they yield the same. All it really tells me is that the farmer may have been over applying whatever fertilizer they're applying at that given point in time, because there just isn't that direct comparison. So you really want to look at a with and without comparison because that's going to be the best data in terms of determining what's going on.
Yeah, I think another thing related to that is getting back to the economic standpoint, and is not just simply the yield, because your result might be that the yield was identical, but now we got to look at what the management was. So was there a more economical management that produced an identical yield? And so a lot of times farmers get real caught up in saying, well, if it didn't find a yield difference, then you didn't find anything. Well, if you actually changed your management and there was no yield difference, maybe you did find something related to, I can do whatever, if it's a reduced rate or apply this product instead of that product and still get the same yield, that's still a result that you need to be thinking about and looking at. Looking at the smell test part about whether when you're all said and done and you're looking at the data, I think it's important to really focus on that whole field and whether you feel like there was quality data. We lost a project this year because a tornado went through. We're not going to use that data. We're not going to try and pretend that somehow the loss from what happened in that field was reciprocal across all of the treatments and that they were all the same and therefore we still have a result. And I was a part of a project a number of years ago where some results were being presented and I had to ask a farmer kind of on the sly at the end. I had him off in the corner and I said, when you showed that yield map, there's some spots in the field where the yield looked like it went to zero. And he said, well, yeah, we had some giant ragweed get away from us. And I said, so you mean it literally was zero, that the giant ragweed was that bad that the yield was zero right there? Yeah, it was. And I said, well, I don't really know that we can trust any of the results from this field if you had spots in the field where the weed control was so bad the yield went to zero. So even though everything might have been laid out properly, you still had to kind of back off and look at what happened out there and say, you know, this trial didn't turn out the way we wanted it to. We really can't use this data.
Yeah, so Brad brings up a really good point about tornadoes and weed control. And hopefully you don't have a tornado every year. But something we also want you to consider when if you're doing these trials is possibly conducting the same trial over a number of years. In the university, we really like to look at research for at least 2 years, just in case something changes. Maybe you have a drought year and that affects your results. Maybe you have a wet year and that affects your results. Or you have something happen in your field that's mitigating your treatment effects. So consider that possibly before you start something. And then also a good point about keeping good notes. Maybe you're working with a cooperator and they're not quite sure, you know, they're not out there every day like you are looking at things. So keeping those good notes so you know at the end of the season if something wonky is going on, that's what it was.
Yeah, you had a hot spot with soybean aphids, mm-hmm. but it didn't justify treating the whole field. Right. You know, maybe in the case of a research project involving soybeans, maybe you'd need to treat it anyway just to make sure you didn't find out, you know, how bad the aphid mm-hmm. problem was and so forth. And you bring up another good point, Annie, about multiple years. And particularly because we're all soil scientists here, I think we need to point out that the loss process for nitrogen is water-driven, and this was a very wet year. And so we're going to see data this year that indicates you probably needed more nitrogen or got a better response to side dress nitrogen. I anticipate all these things because that was the kind of year that we had. And so it is important to put your data in the context of the year. And your point being on doing it multiple years, one of the reasons why we usually do our research projects over, say, at least 2 years, but really preferably four, is hopefully in 4 years you got a wet one, a dry one, and at least two normal ones that you can actually get a better picture of what's going on. And so you do need to look at the context of what the year has been like when you're looking at your results from that trial in order to explain that as well as to decide whether that's usable from here going forward or whether it really just simply told you what happens in a year like this.
Mm-hmm. Any other closing thoughts?
I just say that, you know, like my case in particular, I'm always willing to help farmers with with designing, randomizing, laying these things out. I don't know that I can physically go to everybody's farm and help stake them out, but we could certainly talk over the phone or through email and so forth. So if you want, I'm willing to let you contact me. My email address is bcarlson@umn.edu. It's a very simple one to remember. Or you can just find me on the extension webpage and let me know. And of course, we're also always willing to help you with pointing you in the right direction or getting you going in the right way with statistical analysis when you've got your yield results also.
Yeah, Brad brings up a good point. I would say the exact same thing. You know, we really encourage you if you want to look at something to set up a good trial, and we can definitely help with that. And Brad and I are here, and we have a lot of crops educators throughout the state who can help you put something together and look at your data if you're interested in that.
There are a lot of tools out there, so it's just I think we can point you in the right direction if there's some issue, if you need to set something up, if you're trying to figure something out. So it's always there, because that's an interest of ours in terms of on-farm data, at least to make sure that people are getting it right and getting the best out of it.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, that about does it for the podcast this week. We would like to thank the Minnesota Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council, AFREC, for supporting this podcast. For the latest information on nutrient management, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at UMN Nutrient MGMT, where you can also send us your questions for the next podcast episode. Thanks for listening.